Welcome to The B Word, a podcast about humans, organisations, behaviour. I'm your host, James Healy. Have you ever found yourself ordering the same as your friend at a bar or in a restaurant? Have you ever got up before the seatbelt sign turns off because everyone else on the plane did? Have you ever sped up just because the car next to you did? From dodgy fashion choices to Mexican waves in a sports crowd, we are all profoundly influenced by the behavior of others. But these are relatively trivial examples. What about something bigger? Some of the most famous experiments in the history of psychology look at the role of social norms and the influence of authority on human behavior. Solomon Asch studied the role of subtle group pressure on a simple task like estimating the length of a line. More than 70% of participants gave an obviously wrong answer just to match the group consensus. Asch's student Stanley Milgram famously investigated whether an authority figure, specifically a scientist in a lab coat, could influence people's willingness to administer electric shocks, supposedly as part of a study to incentivize learning. Two-thirds of participants ignored the screams of the student and delivered what they thought was a 450-volt shock, easily enough to kill. Philip Zimbardo converted the basement of the Stanford Psychology Department into a mock prison to see if environment and role could influence behavior. He was forced to end his experiment after 6 days as it descended into anarchy, with prisoners rebelling against the increasingly sadistic behavior of the guards. Underlying each of these experiments was a fundamental question. What makes ordinary people do unspeakable things? In the spring of 1994, a tiny, hitherto largely unknown country in Central Africa was suddenly catapulted into the global spotlight. In the last years of the 20th century, in full view of a largely ambivalent world, a genocide as shocking as anything in human history unfolded. An estimated 800,000 people, one-fifth of the Rwandan population, died in less than 100 days. Many of them hacked to death with machetes by people they knew. What drove large numbers of ordinary Rwandans to commit such unspeakable atrocities? Our guest today has some rather uncomfortable answers. Omar McDoom is Assistant Professor in Comparative Politics in the Government Department at the London School of Economics and Political Science. His research interests lie in the study of conflict and violence between ethnic and religious groups within societies, and more recently the converse, understanding how and why ethnic and religious groups achieve coexistence, conciliation, and even cooperation. Prior to the LSE, he held research fellowships at Harvard University, at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, and then at Oxford University in the Department of Politics and International Relations. Outside of academia, his varied professional experience includes work as a policy officer for the World Bank, as a legal officer for the government of Guyana, and on electoral missions for the OSCE and UN. He co-founded a non-profit organization which develops leadership potential in children affected by Northern Uganda's civil war, named The Child is Innocent. Professor McDoom holds law degrees from King's College London and the Université de Paris, Panthéon Sorbonne, a master's degree in international development studies from George Washington University, and a PhD in development studies from the London School of Economics. He's also an attorney, non-practicing, admitted in the state of New York. Welcome, Omar. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So that's quite the bio. I'm keen to understand a little bit more about you and your background, and particularly how you ended up researching ethnic conflicts.
Well, I was born in London in the 1970s. I can put the exact year on it. But my parents come from the small Caribbean nation of Guyana. But their ancestors, they hail from India, going back two or three generations from my mother and father. And they were Muslim migrants from northern India. So I answered your question by consciously talking about my ethnic and religious background, because ethnicity has become a major theme of research for myself. And that's actually not so unusual, I think, for second generation immigrant academic. Identity politics and intergroup relations and intergroup conflicts, you know, especially between immigrants and natives, that's a major area of research in political science, which is my field. But it's become even more so in recent years. We think about the big structural forces that are shaping these relations. Globalization, which has enabled mass migration from the global south to the global north, and that has raised big questions about the role of multiculturalism in liberal democracies. And then, of course, there's also 9/11, which is a major critical juncture that fundamentally changed relations between the Muslim and the non-Muslim world. So, you know, this liberal idea, and I grew up in a liberal democracy, this liberal idea that ethnic and religious diversity is something to be celebrated and promoted. Well, obviously that's faced very serious, very hard challenges recently, both in terms of real world politics. You think Brexit and then the rise of populist leaders like Trump, Modi in India, Orban in Hungary, who all preach some version of, you know, nativist politics. And then also not just in real world politics, but even in the obscure ivory tower scholarly world, there's just a growing amount of work, that research that's showing that there are links between ethnic diversity in societies and all sorts of problems. Higher levels of diversity have been linked to lack of trust in societies, to the poor quality of governance, to the poor provision of public services. So I've become very interested in this question of, well, you know, what can we do to change that relationship, that kind of tension between ethnic groups and societies. So how you move from ethnic conflict, ethnic distancing, to ethnic coexistence and cooperation. And I focus specifically on the issue of inequality and understanding how inequality between ethnic and social groups, if you reduce those disparities, how does that change the relationship between these groups? So for all those reasons, I think that's why my research has been drawn in the direction of the study of ethnicity and conflict between ethnic groups.
Look, there's a lot of really big themes there and a lot to unpick. I guess much of that came together, 27 years ago now in Rwanda. And I'm keen to hear more about your specific research there and what the key findings were of your work on the Rwandan genocide.
Yes, so the genocide, it registered with me obviously at the time, but its true significance has really taken time to become apparent. Rwanda's genocide has become a world historical event, and it's changed our world in a number of really important and permanent ways. It's helped develop the idea of a responsibility to protect at the international level. It gave impetus to the development of the International Criminal Court to hold individuals and regimes to account for atrocities. It really highlighted the role of sexual violence as a weapon in war when rape was recognized as an act of genocide. And of course, it just stands as an ominous reminder of the cost of inaction, not just in Africa, but obviously there have been many cases where Rwanda has been invoked. Sudan, the Central African Republic, Kenya, Ivory Coast, these are all places where the shadow of Rwanda's genocide has been noted. So I wrote a book about the genocide that was recently published. And the book answers two important, and I think perhaps very common, questions that people have about Rwanda's genocide, which is firstly, just how and why did this happen? And then secondly, why did so many ordinary Rwandans come to participate in the violence itself? Not many, but not all, and that's an important distinction. And the book is an attempt to give rigorous answers to those questions and to attempt to cut through the many theories and hypotheses that we have that answer those questions. So questions, theories around the role of wars, the role of demography and the environment, the role of poverty, the role of ideology, the role of racism, and then more at the micro level, trying to explain individual participation. What was the role of opportunism? What about group behavior and collective forces? What about obedience, bystander effects, impunity effects? All of these myriad hypotheses that exist in the literature on how and why the genocide happened and how and why people came to participate in it. The book was an attempt to kind of use data and social science theory to answer those two big questions. It's based on field work, time spent in Rwanda, going back over 10 years now, many field trips, and some of the data, some of the evidence that I draw on includes interviews with several hundred of those Rwandans who participated in the violence, as well as interviews with individuals who didn't, from the same communities, to try to get at this question of why did some people come to participate and others not. I also did case studies of communities, communities where the violence happened quickly, communities where it happened late, where the violence was intense and where it was not so intense. All of these, you know, very explicit research design. So that's to give you a sense of what the research is about and what the book tries to do.
Look, it's a fascinating topic, and I vividly recall the Rwandan genocide occurring. I think for someone of my age, it was something of a rude awakening because I was old enough to have studied sufficient history to have a good understanding of the Holocaust and had been fed the line that never again, this cannot be allowed to happen. And there had obviously been various subsequent genocides, acts of genocide around the world. But what was really shocking about Rwanda was that it happened in full view of the world. It essentially happened live on television in the late 20th century. And of course, very little was done. As my other personal connection with Rwanda, I visited there in 2008. And I remember very vividly the realization on my first day there that essentially everyone over the age of 14 at that point would have a genocide story. Perhaps they were too young to remember it. But everyone you saw over that age was essentially either a victim, a perpetrator, a bystander, or something else. And I think that is the other thing about Rwanda. It was almost the whole society impacted by it. And I think from reading some of your work, that links into a couple of the key themes. And really one of the things I'd like to explore with you today around the role of social networks, social influence, and things like bystander effect. So what were your key findings there, and what was the most surprising of those?
So this was originally part of my PhD, and before I went to Rwanda to try to answer these questions around why some people participated and others didn't, I've been strongly influenced by, like you, some of the research that came out of studies of the Holocaust, right? And I really had this very strong idea that the killers were ordinary and that there was nothing distinctive about them. And that largely ties in with some of the psychosocial work that has been done since the Holocaust, some of the classic work by Solomon Ash on conformity, Milgram on obedience and authority, Zimbardo's work on role adoption. All of these point to kind of situationalist explanations that anybody finding themselves in these situations would be able to, would be capable of committing these acts of atrocity. So I was very strongly influenced by that. And so I went in and decided I wanted to test this rigorously by not only looking and talking to the participants, those who actually did commit acts of violence and kill individuals, but also I wanted to talk to those who didn't, and to see if there were differences in their beliefs, in their attitudes, in their demographic profiles. And to cut a very long story short, this big survey that I did, nearly 300 Rwandans, the participants and the non-participants, failed to yield any statistically significant differences between these two groups, those who participated, those who didn't. So It was somewhat troubling that I didn't have an answer to this question of differential selection, why some did and some didn't. But I went back to Rwanda, and I had this idea that perhaps it wasn't so much who you were, you know, the idea that your disposition mattered, but maybe it was, you know, where you lived, and maybe it was who you knew that mattered. So situational and also relational. And what I did was I went back to one of the communities that I knew really well in Rwanda. And it was a community of about just under 3,500 Rwandans. And I knew this community intimately. I knew who the participants had been, who the bystanders were, who the victims were, who the survivors were. And one of the first things we did was to simply geocode the household locations of all of these individuals. And we created a map that simply showed where people lived in 1994 in relation to each other. And this was very interesting. When we looked at the pattern, the spatial settlement pattern, it became very apparent that there was something going on here about where you live, the situational, literally the micro-situational settlement patterns seemed to matter. And what we found was that individuals who participated in the violence tended to live within the same neighborhood as other participants in the violence. And we attempted to quantify this, and what we found is that there was this neighborhood effect. We drew circles of different radii around households, 100 meters, and we counted who lived within 100 meters of the killer, and then 200 meters and 300 meters. And what we found is that up to about 300 meters within that sphere of influence, you were much more likely to be drawn into the violence if you lived within 300 meters with somebody else who participated in the violence. So this told us that something had something to do about with where you lived. We then asked the question, well, what is it about the neighborhood that makes you more likely to participate in it? And it could be that individuals are simply drawn to live close to each other. This principle of homophily in social networks, that birds of a feather tend to flock together. We ruled that out in Rwanda, partly because of the difficulty of simply purchasing land and moving in the same way as you could in, say, you know, a place like Perth, for example, or a big city in a major democracy where the land market operates, but it doesn't work like that in Rwanda. Individuals inherit land, and it's passed down generation after generation. So then we started thinking about, well, maybe it had something to do with social influence, the relational idea that it was who you knew. So we took a subset of these 3,500 individuals, and we mapped their social networks, both of the killers and the non-killers. And what we found was indeed that the killers had very different social networks to the non-killers. Counterintuitively, the killers had bigger social networks. They were simply more connected to other individuals in their communities than the non-killers were. So structurally then, their networks were simply bigger. And this was counterintuitive because often we think of social capital, the trust that you have between individuals, the connections that you have on Twitter, we think of that as a positive force. But here I was finding that it was the individuals who were the least connected in their communities who were the ones more likely not to participate in the violence, and the ones who were more pro-social in the sense that they were better connected were the ones who were more likely to be drawn into the antisocial behavior. So, and this is why I termed the phrase anti-social capital. So that was kind of one of the big surprising facts or outcomes was that social capital also has this kind of dark side to it as well.
That is indeed very surprising, and it's very troubling. I'm reminded of some accounts of Milgram's work with the famous electric shock experiments, where supposedly his intention going into that work was to demonstrate some kind of innate tendency among Germans for being particularly obedient, being willing to do, shall we say, unspeakable acts because they were told to do so. And you read about his increasing despair as he repeats the experiment and changes various aspects of it and finds exactly the same results with Americans, and is eventually forced to the truly terrifying conclusion that most people have a level of susceptibility to social influence, authority influence, which can make them do almost anything. And I think that when thinking about genocide, the question that you ultimately arrive at is, what would I do in that situation? And we all think that we have an answer to that. Work like yours leads to some very troubling conclusions and suggests that perhaps that answer is not as clear-cut as we would all like to think.
Indeed. I asked myself that question too. One of the first places I visited when I went to Rwanda was Nyamata, which was a church. And there was a guest book there. And one of the entries in that guest book says, from I think it was a British visitor who asked the question, would I have done the same thing if I found myself in this situation? And I use that actually at the start of the book because I do ask myself that same question. And I think none of us knows the answer until we find ourselves in that situation, whether we would have behaved differently. Easy as it is to kind of distance and revile those who participated, we do have to ask this difficult question about whether we would have behaved differently ourselves. You know, Milgram's work is interesting when we look at it, because often it's people take away what you rightly just said, that it suggests that maybe we would all, or many of us would behave similarly faced with those circumstances. And if you look more closely at Milgram's work, it's more, there's something else that you can take away from it. So Milgram's original experiment involved, I think, 40 individuals who had responded to an advertisement in New Haven. And of those 40 in the original experiment, 26 did turn the dial and inflict pain on that patient, subject, actor. But that still means that 14 individuals did not, right? Which gives us some hope for humanity. And if you also take Zimbardo's work, where he simulated a prison and he invited, I think it was 21 college students to participate in this. And of those 21, I think it was 11 who played the roles of the guards. And of those 11 who played the roles of guards, only a small number of them, I think it was about a third, began to display these worrying, aggressive tendencies that caused him to have to abandon the experiment ultimately. And I found something similar in Rwanda. Disposition mattered, situation mattered, and relations mattered. All three sets of factors mattered. But on the disposition, I found that there were distinctions. It wasn't that everybody had the same attitude. I called it commitment to the killing or commitment to the genocidal project. And I found that there were very clear differences that allowed me to conclude that there was heterogeneity in the Rwandan population, just as Milgram found it in the New Haven population and Zimbardo found it in his college student population. There was that variation in the way that people responded in Rwanda. And I crudely classified them into extremists, people who had the highest level commitment to killing, opportunists who had a lower threshold, and then conformists. And then finally, also those who refused to participate in the violence, whom I called not pacifists, I think that's quite the right phrase, but resistors to the violence. So there was variation there in individual disposition within Rwanda as well.
So I find that variation very interesting. And you see something similar in lots of spheres, whether it's adoption of new technology or adoption of any kind of change. And I think there's definitely something in that. I guess I'm keen to understand from you what you feel the lessons from your work might be outside of extreme situations like genocide. What can individuals, organizations, and indeed societies learn from this?
So one of the more surprising and interesting findings was about radicalization. You know, I was looking at radicalization in the context of genocide. And often we think of radicalization in other contexts. You know, we think about this to deal with terrorism. We think about this even in just ordinary politics, right? We think about radicalized or polarized societies where, say, natives get set against migrants or ethnic groups become polarized against each other. So I went in thinking that radicalization was something that is temporarily antecedent to violence, right? That you have radicalized individuals, radicalized communities, and then you would see violence becomes more likely as a result of that. So individuals hold these negative, these extreme negative views about the outgroup, whatever that's, you know, whatever it is in Rwanda, the Tutsi outgroup. So maybe they resent them, they fear them, they hate them, they dehumanize them. They have all of these attitudes and these beliefs about them that are negative in some way. So what I found in Rwanda that was surprising is that this radicalization didn't only precede the behavior, the violence, it also followed it. And what I mean by that is that I found that there were individuals who did not hold strongly negative views of the outgroup before they killed. But it was through the act of violence, through their behavior, that their attitudes changed, that they developed these negative views. They came to dehumanize, they came to hate, they came to resent, they came to fear through the act of violence itself. So radicalization was both a cause and a consequence of killing. So that's perhaps not surprising to a student of social psychology, that attitudes drive behavior, yes, but behaviors also drive attitudes. But I found this fascinating because when talking to the Rwandans about this shift, in cases where it was radicalization ex post, the change, the attitudinal shift, was a form of dissonance reduction. It was a way of coping with what they had done. So we think about some of these psychosocial mechanisms such as habituation or desensitization. These are ways that individuals are able to kind of justify to themselves what they have done. So these attitudes, these beliefs, these negative views become the way of justifying their behavior. And I think that's important when we think about intergroup relations, even in non-genocidal contexts, just in ordinary liberal democratic contexts, where we still see tensions, conflicts arise between groups. I think that there are lessons here about how individuals are mobilized and how attitudes are formed.
That's fascinating. And I'm reminded of a quote from Katharine Hepburn, of all people. If you want to change attitudes, start with a change in behavior, which of course runs completely counter to what most people would think is the logical flow. And I think it's really fascinating that in this extreme example, we see the converse. We see that attitudes shift as a response to behavior, as a way of justifying the behavior that's already happened. And I think there are really powerful lessons there in terms of everyday life. And I think in terms of understanding that we are not as rational or as logical as we like to think.
Indeed. You know, one of the interesting implications of this finding that, you know, radicalization can follow the behavior, can follow the violence, is to do with explaining, well, what causes then individuals to join, to participate, to commit, to behave in that way. And so we've talked already about, you know, social influence, social forces, and how that drives individuals to participate, whether it's authority and obedience, whether it's conformity, whether it's roles that they're given. But there are these powerful social forces at work that might explain how individuals behave, and then their attitudes follow. And Rwanda is interesting because the scale of the mobilization was just extraordinary, and the scale of the violence was extraordinary. I mean, violence, genocide is exceptional, but even for a genocide, Rwanda's violence was remarkable just for the sheer speed and scale of the mobilization and the killing. And one of the questions I looked at in the book is to answer that specifically. Well, why? Why was it so extraordinary? And it comes back to this question about social forces. And I asked myself, why were these social forces so powerful in Rwanda? And the answer has something to do with sociodemography in Rwanda. And this is interesting because it's an explanation, I suppose, that tries to show that these social forces vary in their strength between societies. And it was particularly powerful. They were particularly powerful in Rwanda for two reasons. One, which is well known, one demographic fact which is well known, is the Rwanda's extraordinary population density. Rwanda is the most densely populated country in sub-Saharan Africa and one of the most densely populated countries in the world. And that gave rise very early on in scholarship on the genocide to theories about Malthusian arguments, too many people, too little land. But I actually found that it was less ecological and more sociological. And what I found is that in communities where people live in very close proximity to each other, the networks are very, very dense, that this meant that the social forces, conformity, coercion, co-optation, that they're amplified through these dense social networks. It becomes very difficult to kind of escape and avoid detection when you live in these social networks, which both enable you to do things and also constrain you from doing things as well. So that's one big thing. The second big thing that I think explains why in Rwanda these social forces were so strong was the fact that Rwanda was one of the least urbanized, was the least urbanized country in sub-Saharan Africa at the time. It's not now. But 93% of Rwandans in 1994 lived in rural areas. That's interesting because rural sociology is quite distinctive and very different from urban sociology. You go back to the classic sociological work, people like Georges Simmel, Durkheim, Ternes, and we start thinking about the ties that exist between individuals in rural contexts compared with individuals in urban contexts. They're very different, right? Anonymity is much harder. Their relationships are less transient. They're also multiplex, meaning that individuals have multiple ties to each other. So, you know, this is kind of similar to Durkheim's idea of mechanical rather than organic solidarity, where individuals are tied, you know, through ties of affection and loyalty. And also Tony's idea of, and Weber's idea of, you know, Gemeinschaft rather than Gesellschaft. So all of these kind of classic sociological theories you can bring to bear in explaining the strength of the social forces that were operating in Rwanda in 1994. And, you know, it simply meant that it was very difficult to hide, very difficult to escape social obligations. And they amplified these social influences and help explain the remarkable speed and of the violence and the remarkable scale of the popular mobilization in Rwanda.
Look, it's fascinating stuff, and there's a huge amount. I could talk about this all night. We haven't even got on to the consequences of the genocide and the range of wars that followed in Central Africa, but that's not the focus of this conversation. So before we wrap up, one final question. You've obviously seen the negative impacts of social networks and network effects. What would you say are some of the positive impacts or positive effects of social networks?
So I think that's an interesting question. So I often think of networks as neutral, and that they can, like any technology, I suppose, be harnessed for good and for bad. And in fact, the conventional wisdom generally is that they are forces in society that you want to encourage. Some of the mechanisms that I found at work in Rwanda through these social networks can be used for all sorts of normatively desirable outcomes. Thinking about the role of information diffusion, you think about Mark Granovetter's classic work on the strength of weak ties. So knowing many people allows information to diffuse. It helps the individual. It helps the community. It also has a kind of regulatory function. It regulates the behavior of individuals because you do have influence that flows along these networks. So as I point out, though, that influence can be worked, can be harnessed for bad things like committing genocide. And then also you see another important mechanism, it has important functions as for building cohesion in societies, for strengthening identities. People feel these ties to each other. So around identity formation, identity strengthening as well. So those are some of the kind of classic thoughts around, I suppose, the value of social networks. Also the ideas of trust and, you know, it's one of the resources that are in here in social networks.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your time, Omar. This has been hugely enjoyable and hugely informative.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So I'm sure that made for some fairly uncomfortable listening at times. There's something deeply troubling about the idea that any of us, put in the right circumstances, might be capable of this kind of behavior. But although genocide is an extreme scenario, there are some really practical takeaways from Omar's work. So often, behavior shapes attitudes, not the other way around. And social networks and peer pressure, even implicit peer pressure, are incredibly powerful drivers of behavior. Fundamentally, if you want to change behavior, change the social environment. If social factors can influence people to commit acts of genocide, imagine what else they can do. You've been listening to The B Word, a podcast produced by Margot Zunis and Emma Stewart, and presented by me, James Healy.